Good morning, everybody. My name is Ray Vowell, and I'm an alcoholic. And, Mike, I'd like to say I've had the privilege of speaking in 48 of the 50 states and three foreign countries, and that was probably the lousiest introduction I ever had. When do you suppose that chairmen and introducers will ever learn that the people they're introducing are going to have the podium immediately following them? I'd like to add a special thanks to the mouth of the conference, Tony. And certainly would not want to leave out Tom I, who in his usual fashion has dispersed the crowd before I got to speak. I love Tom. I'd rather hear Tom speak than to eat. I've heard him do both. On the program, I am listed as Reverend Ray V. I suppose that's probably the only time that word has ever been connected to my name. Certainly not at any church that I ever pastored. I want to get a few thank yous out of the way. Let me preface anything I say. Let me just stop right here and say this, that if you get through before I get through, it's all right for you to go on home. Because I always try to quit when I'm finished. But I have been known not to. I have been known to talk 20 minutes after I got through. And you'll be able to recognize that right off the bat. I want to thank the committee. Joycey called me and she said... we had met over in Douglasville years ago and invited me to come, and I jumped at the opportunity because I'm a Georgian originally from LaGrange, and it's always good to come back. AA in Georgia is good. Atlanta AA is really, really good. I just got to tell you, most hospitable group that I've ever been with. And I want to thank Betsy for the great job you've done doing this. I know you had a lot of help, but I mean, it's just, I got to tell you what, it's for a Yankee, it was great. I've had a lot of conversations on the phone with Betsy, and if I could figure out what she said, I would love to tell y'all about it. But I would call Joyce and she would explain, and so it was okay. I can't remember everybody on the committee, but Lori, I want to thank you for being such a kind person. And I went up to Lori on Friday and I said, do you think we could get somebody to take us to one of the malls? And she said, why don't you just take my car? I thought, well, I don't know anybody that I would have done that to. You don't really. And then she gives me a cell phone to take with me in the car. And I said, does this do 900 numbers? And she said, well. But I had forgotten that I had my wife with me, so she was pretty safe. But I just have to share something with you that since... it's been so indiscreetly thrown around here that I am a Baptist preacher. I've been to the Southern Baptist Convention 24 times and nobody has ever offered me their car. And then especially I do not want to leave out Rita. If you don't know what Rita does, that probably won't mean anything to you, but Rita's the treasurer. You always want to stay close to the treasurer, right? If you haven't traveled around doing this, they won't understand that. All right. Met a lot of new friends and made contact with some old friends. Frankie Rice, it's so good to see you. Just Brookins. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell them how we met, Brookins, but gosh, what a temptation. Dr. Bill R. from down in LaGrange is here, and we go back a long way. John, my favorite Santa Claus. My aspiration is to be like John. So it shows you how low my ambitions are. But and then Lucy's and then Lucy's here, and I don't want to leave out Stan, because my wife's over there going, and I wouldn't do that. I've known Stan for a long time. And then there's a young man from LaGrange sitting back over in here, and I used to date his aunt. I really kind of liked his mother. But I'm going to leave that part out of the story today, I can assure you. Okay, I think I got everything out of the way. Now, this will get me in trouble, but I have to do this. I want to introduce the most important person in my life today, my wife. The reason she's so important in my life, other than obvious reasons, is that everything you hear from me today, she lived double. Because for 45 years we've been married. And which doesn't say much for intelligence, but she is a kind person. And very tenacious. She just got that stick-to-itiveness. The only argument I've won in 45 years is I'm smarter than she is. Well, you can look at who she married and tell that. I mean, I wouldn't have married somebody like she did, and if I had, I wouldn't have stayed there. I can tell you that. So anyway, I did want to say that. And then let's get on with the business at hand. As I already said, I'm an alcoholic. I'm a preacher. I'm a Baptist preacher. I'm a Southern Baptist preacher. And I don't apologize for that here this morning, because it's I'm no more ashamed of that than I am being an alcoholic. It's it's incurable. You just have to learn to live with it. I also have a PhD in psychology, so I'm a therapist. And might just get all that out of the way, because I'm all the things you like to talk about in meetings. And all those things are okay as long as I remember the first one. I think if I had it all to do over again, I probably would not be a Southern Baptist preacher. I think I would probably be a televangelist. I love the concept of telling people to send their money to God and giving them my address. I will have to say that I'm a little bit shaken in my trust in televangelism lately, because these people have a tendency to say to you and me, God told me to tell you. And that implies that if I don't agree with them, I'm disagreeing with God. I'm not sure that that's truthful. It would appear to me that if God talked to these people the way they claim, he would have said, Jimmy, don't pick up the girl. The police is right behind you. Yeah. that's the, that's the, you know, that's kind of my opinion, and I'm not, I'm not being critical. I'm just, it's just an observation. He's a nice fellow, and I met him only once, and he said to me, I don't believe in what you do because alcoholism is not a disease. If it were, it would be the only one you could buy. And I said, don't leave out syphilis and gonorrhea. I haven't heard from him since. Nor do I expect to. Being all of these things, I'm working on a manuscript now entitled Multiple Personality is Not Necessarily a Disorder. You know, I don't know about you guys, but you know, when I came into AA, and I've only been sober since July the 20th, 1971, so I'm certainly not guru'd yet, but, you know, it seems to me that people are still constantly finding ways to blame their problem on other people. Yeah. And I hate the term dysfunctional family. My God, you know, where are they? Yeah. If that is a correct term, where are the functions? You know, I've researched this out. I can't find a source for functions. You know, if you believe as I do, and I don't apologize, for I read the Bible. I know it's not approved AA literature, but I read it at night when nobody's looking. And it says in there that the world began with Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve lived, they had two children, Cain and Abel. And one of their boys killed the other one. And they got evicted from the first home they had. Does that sound functional to you? So where did the functional people come from? Yeah. Traditionally and historically, it is believed that the world was destroyed by a flood, all except one family, Noah. Three boys, Ham, Shem, and Japheth, and their three wives, and Noah's wife. Actually, eight people left in the world. They floated around for 6 months, no dry land. One day, they bumped into a mountain, bailed out of the ark, looked for a dry place, and planted a crop. Did they plant corn? Yeah. Wheat? Yeah. Grapes. And as soon as they got the crop in, Noah got drunk and got naked in front of his kids. Check me out, it's in the book. So where did the functions come from? Beats me. I come from a totally functional family. My father was I don't know if he was an alcoholic or not, but he drank an awful lot of whiskey. I know the first thing that he bought every week was his whiskey. And I functioned real well. He functioned real well. You know, he got drunk every Friday and stayed drunk till Monday, and he went back to work and he worked till Friday. He got drunk and stayed drunk till Monday. So I suppose that was his job. I know it was my job for 20-something years. People always calling me up and saying, well, my husband, my wife got drunk. I said, well, they're alcoholic. That's what alcoholics do. That's their work. Why are you surprised? You're not surprised that Dennis spills tea. You're not surprised that truck drivers are up and down 285. Why are you surprised when an alcoholic gets drunk? I don't understand that. So we functioned real well. There's an old hymn that goes back a long way, and it says, this world is not my home, I'm just passing through. Now, I got to tell you something. That says a whole lot about me and about people like us. This world is not our home. We don't fit. If we didn't have places like this to come and conclave occasionally, we would be dysfunctional. Because there's no hole out there for us. You know, I mean, the places left for us are places nobody else wanted. So, I believe that we're the most fortunate people on the face of the earth. I am convinced as I stand here this morning that God loves us more than he loves anybody else. Now, I know that that got real quiet when I said that. I don't make statements here that I can't support. Now, listen to me. The problem of alcoholism is signified and it delineates itself by one thing called moreism. We want more of anything than anybody in the world, right? I cannot remember in my life ever wanting one of anything. And God knows how we are. He gave the whole world 10 commandments. He gave us 12 steps. Because he knew that if we didn't have more than everybody else, we wouldn't be interested. Now, one other little point. The commandments are not optional. The 12 steps are suggested. How many of you have ever successfully worked the 10 commandments? Okay, the guy back in the corner, you're lying. Put your hand down. I broke all of them as soon as I got old enough to reach them. And you did too. So because this world is not our home, weird things happen. And they seem rather normal to us. There's a whole world of people out here, folks, in Atlanta today and in Georgia and all over this country and all over the world that are a whole lot crazier than we are and don't have a clue why. One of our favorite pastimes at my house is to take my wife shopping. That was another commandment. I always get dry when I lie. Goes back to jail last days. The way we shop is we go to the mall and I sit in the middle of the mall and Pay goes from store to store and comes by occasionally and gets some more money. You know, I'm going to put on her tombstone a statue of her with MasterCard in one hand and Discover in the other, running toward Walmart hollering, "Charge!" Biggest lie in the world is, could we stop at Walmart a minute? Now, I found a way to speed up this shopping process is I sit in front of Victoria's Secret. And by the way, Victoria doesn't have any secrets. I was looking at last Christmas, I'm sitting there in front of Victoria's Secret. Little girl comes out and she says, "She's got this teddy. It's rather attractive garment, you know. As I remember, it was sort of a red satin with black lace overlay, and I didn't pay much attention to it, but it was. And it had some little furry stuff in strategic places, and in some strategic places it didn't have anything. And she said, "Wouldn't you like to get your wife one of these for Christmas?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd love to. Do you have it in flannel?" And so anyway, I'm sitting here in front of Victoria's Secret waiting on her, and this couple comes down through the mall. And they were a strange looking couple. She's barefooted and got jeans on that don't have much material in them, and didn't have a whole lot on otherwise. And this boy had a punk haircut, and it was spiked out to here. And it was orange on one side and blue on the other. And they stop right in front of where I'm sitting, and there's a little stand there that sells sunglasses. And he picks up a pair of sunglasses, and he puts them on, and he turns to this girl, and he said, "How do these look?" And she says, "Take those off, they make you look stupid." This world is not my home. It's strange. It's really strange. You know, it's... The other morning in church, a lady passed by right in front of where I was sitting. She had four little kids with her. Stops right in front of me, and she says to those kids, "Do y'all want a whipping?" That's probably the dumbest question I've heard. You know, I'm sitting there thinking, I wonder what her reaction would be if one of those kids said, "Yeah, Mama, beat the hell out of her. Hit me first. He was first yesterday." This world is not my home. United States Post Office. Every post office in this country has a sign on the front door that says, "No dogs allowed except seeing eye dogs." Who else is supposed to read that? Kind of makes you wonder, doesn't it? So the world's always been a crazy place. I was going to go to medical school, and they never did recognize my potential. Nobody ever told me I had great potential. Well, they did. They said I had great potential to become a patient. Now, we talked about this last night in the car, that I wrote brilliant exam papers. The graders couldn't read them. As a matter of fact, I just didn't understand why I would get low grades, because I'd drink a pint of whiskey and I'd go in and I'd take those exams and I would expound brilliantly and then I'd get a F. One time I got a unattempted. And I went back to see the professor and I said, "I want you to know that I know that material front and back." And he said, "Well, here's your paper." And there was nothing written on it. But I had sat there and thought about it for about an hour and a half, and I had all the answers formulated in my mind. I just forgot to write them down. And so, anyway, wasn't any big deal. When they told me I couldn't be a doctor, I went about four blocks down the street and enrolled in the Kentucky School of Mortuary Science. Well, if you can't be a doctor, you'd be an embalmer, you know, funeral director, whatever, you know. And I had most of the courses. I had anatomy, I had physiology, I had, biochemistry, I had all these courses. And so I became an embalmer and a funeral director, and I moved back to LaGrange and worked there for several years. The big thing in funeral directing is you know you've made it when they let you talk to live people. You can talk to the other people all you want to, and the day came when they were real busy, and they said, "Okay, we're going to let you deal with this family." Well, the circumstances were this old bachelor had died on a farm outside of town, and he was about 65, 70 years old, and he had three sisters and one brother. His brother had been in Milledgeville for 24 years, and they went to get him and brought him with them to help make the arrangements. And so I'm practicing my funeral director demeanor. You know, the hardest thing about being a funeral director is looking sad at a $20,000 funeral. Now that's tough.
Thank you.
So we're doing real well, and we've already decided, you know, we're going to have the funeral, who's going to sing, who's going to preach, flowers, clothes. And I'm thinking, I'm doing such a wonderful job here till we got to the place where we're going to bury the man. And they got in this terrible argument. And one sister said, well, brother wanted to be buried at the old home place. And another sister said, no, he did not. He wanted to be buried up in the new memorial cemetery. And another one said, no, you're crazy. Brother was a veteran. He wanted to be buried in the veteran cemetery. Well, one of them turns around to this guy who's been in Milledgeville 24 years. And she said, brother, you haven't said anything. Said, where did you think he wanted to be buried? He said, hell, far as I know, he didn't want to be buried. And they had him locked up. My last funeral was on the day that John Kennedy was shot. It was over in Alabama. Little church, half the size of this room. And we had flowers that you went in the door, we hung them on the wall, all the way down the wall, all the way across the back, all the way down the other wall, all the way back to the door. We had to move flowers for the preacher to get into the pulpit. We had 3 truckloads of flowers. And this lady, who weighed about 400 pounds, stood up amongst those flowers. And she folds her hands, and you can't see but about this much of her because she's totally surrounded by flowers. And she folds her hands and she sings, when the time has come for my leaving, and I must bid you adieu, don't spend no money for flowers, just one rose will do. And my boss said, if you laugh, you're fired. And I said, write my check. So as life progressed and as alcoholism progressed, and I finally wound up, and after I'd been sober a little while, I felt like the Lord had called me to preach. And yes, I did develop a craving for chicken, an aversion to work, and all other men's wives began to look appealing to me. And no, I'm just kidding. And so I got out of the seminary, and I got a little church down in Simmons City, Texas. Didn't have 7 members. And I went out to visit the flock. So, 3 of those 7 members were 3 little old maids that lived by themselves. Now, we don't say old maid in the Baptist church anymore because that's poor terminology. We say single by choice. And you know, I'm almost 66 years old. This terminology thing really has me thrown. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say anymore. You know, we can't say hymnal in the Baptist church anymore. We tried saying hernal, and that didn't work. And you know what? It's really hard when the choir director stands up on Sunday morning and said, everybody stand and take your personal in hand. You know, it loses something. And so I'm visiting these 3 little old ladies that are single by choice, whom I personally feel if they'd ever had a choice, but they And they said, would you like some coffee and cake? And I said, well, of course. And so they go out and they fix the coffee and the cake, and they don't let that bother you because it's broken. I just want to be sure that no alcoholic stole it while I was talking. They go out to fix the refreshments, and I look over, and there's a bowl of peanuts on the table, and I got a handful of peanuts, and I ate them, and they hadn't come back, and I reached over, I got another handful. And before they came back, I ate the whole bowl. And the lady comes in, and she said, well, I see you found our peanuts. And I said, yes, ma'am, I'm sorry. I didn't really mean to eat all of them. She said, no problem. Said, since we had our teeth pulled, all we can do is suck the chocolate off of them anyway. So So we're sitting there drinking coffee and eating cake. And I look up on the piano and there's a glass of water with a condom floating in it. And I'm trying not to look at it. Have you ever noticed when there's something you don't want to look at, no matter where you look, there it is? And I couldn't stand it. And I finally said, "What is that?" And the lady said, "We don't know. We found it in the park." And it said on the package, "Place on organ for prevention of disease." And she said, "We don't own an organ, so we just put it up there on the piano." And she said, "We haven't even had a cold all winter." So I tell you that story because it reminds me of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have a clue how it works, and yet it's successful for us. I remember asking, I was up in Omaha at the Cornhusker Roundup. I told that story, and a little lady came up to me afterwards. She said, "You didn't finish the story." I said, "What story?" She said, "What about the condom?" I said, "I thought I did." She said, "Why was it in water?" I said, "Tell you, I don't know. I made the whole thing up, you know." I mean, you don't really think that a Southern Baptist preacher right out of the seminary sitting in a room with three old maids talking about a condom, do you? If you believe that, we're through. Wow. Anyway. So I just wanted to tell you that to share with you that this world is not my home. If I didn't have Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have survived. I can tell you that now. I look back at all the things that I wanted when I was a teenager. And you know what? I believe every one of them would have killed me. I don't believe if I had achieved one single thing that was my goal as a teenager, I would have survived and lived. Because every one of them would have been, they were destructive. So now that I've said all that, let's get to the business at hand and tell you how much I remember. My wife said this morning, "Keep it spiritual." And I said, "Well, I'm going to say this." She said, "You don't tell that, are you?" So my talk's only going to be 7 minutes. In 1971, in a little tract home out in Irving, Texas, my wife came to me one evening and said, "The children and I have had a meeting and we have audited you." And I said, "How'd I make up?" And she said, "We have determined that it cost us $500 a month more to keep you than you bring in. And we can't afford you anymore." And I said, "Well, what am I going to do?" And she said, "I don't know. Well, you're not going to do it here anymore." Well, I'm an alcoholic. I'm not stupid. I've never been accused of being stupid. By the way, the idea that all alcoholics are supremely intelligent, that's another thing you only hear in AA, Tom. Never heard that said anywhere else. You know, I've never gone to church and heard the preacher say, "You know what? Alcoholics are really intelligent people." It's only in AA that I hear that. And it's okay. I believe it. I accept it. I love it. Love the concept. But, I mean, I'm not saying I didn't do stupid stuff. But I was not stupid. And so I realized that she had deteriorated further than I realized. And I asked if I might use her telephone. And I didn't have one. And she said, "For what?" And I said, "I want to call AA." And she said, "You've done that before. It's no good." And I said, "But this time, it'll be different." Because I had a pattern. I would call Alcoholics Anonymous, and there was no people there. There was an answering machine. And it would say, "You've reached the Irving group of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no one here at this time." And I'd hang up, and then I'd talk to the phone, and I'd confess, you know, and I'd go back and she'd say, "What did they say?" And I'd say, "They said maybe you ought not to drink any more red wine. It's upsetting your stomach and giving you a bad attitude. Maybe I'll switch to a good white wine." And a good white wine, you can tell by counting the threads on the screw cap. I mean, that's, I'm a wine connoisseur. I want you to know that. I wouldn't drink that old cheap stuff with corks in it. Because I was not a cheap drunk. I want y'all to know I was not a low-bottom drunk. I have on occasion taken my socks off with a putty knife, but I was not a low-bottom drunk. I went in and I called Alcoholics Anonymous and I got a people on the phone. Right, that scared me to death. And I said, I think I'd like to talk to somebody about drinking. And he said, we're having a meeting right now. Are you able to come? And I said, yeah, where are you? And he gave me the address and I said, can you come if you've been drinking? And he said, yeah, most people do come that way. And so I went back into the garage where I was staying most of the time in those days, and I got the Mad Dog Deucey Deucey out. If you're not familiar with that, it's a fine old cultural wine because I was in my ethnic period at this time. I poured out a big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey, and my wife said, what are you going to do? And I said, they said, have a drink and come on down there. Because you have to understand that alcoholics have the ability to hear what they want to hear regardless of what's been said. And that's what saves us a lot of times. And so I had this big glass of Mad Dog Deucey Deucey and I set out for my first AA meeting. And when I got there, they were gone. And that didn't surprise me because it wasn't unusual in those days for me to call somebody and tell them I was coming and they'd be gone when I got there. What I did is I in Irving, there's an east and a west Irving Boulevard, and they're actually only a block apart. The road forks, and I went to East Irving Boulevard, west, and the meeting was at east, and I went to a real estate sales meeting, and they looked like alcoholics. I asked them if they were alcoholics, and they broke up the sales meeting. And I figured by now I have made enough effort to correct our lives for one day. And I went back home and everything I owned was on the front porch. And that wasn't any major deal. It all fit in one pillowcase. And I rang the doorbell. Faye hollered through the door, what do you want? And I said, can I use your phone again? They were gone. And so she let me back in. I called back down. I know now they'll be gone. I can talk to the machine. She'll feel better and we can get on with life. Got the people on the phone again. And the guy says, what can I do for you? And I said, I may have a drinking problem. And I'd like for you to send one of your representatives over here in 3 or 4 days. Or let's make an appointment to talk about this. And he says, we can come right now. Well, I'm not stupid. My stuff's out on the porch. My wife has not yet closed the door. And I'm on the phone talking to some idiot drunk who wants to come to my house at 11:30 at night. And I said, come on. And I said to my wife, get the children and get in the back. Because big stuff's sitting down here. Now, what they were going to do is they were coming to my house that Faye bought and was paying for. She's an RN, by the way. That's the only reason we survived. She's really good at it. She wasn't, I'd be dead. They were going to come to my house and tell me I couldn't drink. And I was going to whip their ass. And then they'd go home, and I'd have some more Bad Dog Dizzy Dizzy, and that'd be the end of that story. Because it happened to me all the time. I don't know about you, but people were eternally telling me I couldn't drink. You know? My dad told me that. You know? He came in my bedroom, and I'm a teenager. I don't know how old. And he says, you know, son, you can't drink. I peeked all over the bed and halfway across the floor. And I left home. Sheriff's deputy that drove me out to the county, they said, your major problem is you can't drink. I joined the Navy, and I hadn't been in the Navy 3 months till I woke up one morning, some big old mean-looking chief petty officer shaking my bed saying, son, you know, your problem is you can't drink. I've had total strangers walk up to me, and I'd be laying flat on my back in the gutter, puking straight up. Now, I'm in trouble because I'm not supposed to say puke behind the podium. My wife says, you're an educated man. You've got four college degrees. Why do you say puke? Because I never did anything but puke. I never burped up, chucked, threw up, or vomited in my life. I puke. It's not a bad deal, by the way. You know, I can still puke without getting any on my shoes. I might get some on your shoes, but that. So, you know, and they say, you can't drink. I don't know what they thought I was doing. I could drink, folks. I wasn't a good father, and I was a terrible husband, an awful employee. Not much of a citizen, a terrible son, but I could drink. And you know what? These two idiots come to my house now. God has a sense of humor. James and John made a 12-step call on me on July the 19th, 1971. I guess Peter and Paul were off that night. And they talked idiotic. Bomb people. They said, take it easy. Well, you can take it much easier than I was taking it. Let go and let God. One of those guys actually said that. I didn't have a hold of anything. If I had, God wouldn't have wanted it. I'll guarantee that. And then one of those idiots said, do you think you could go one day without a drink? And I said, well, of course. And the other one said, when did you? I said, I don't keep records, that sort of thing. You know, I'm 28 years later, I stand here. I still don't remember how long it had been since I'd gone a 24-hour period without a drink. It's not important anymore, but I know that I had not willingly or voluntarily done it in my remembrance. And they said, would you be willing to go one day without a drink? And I said, well, I will tomorrow because it's already too late today. And they said, would you go the rest of today? And for some reason, I said yes. I don't know why. The next day, I went to work. I don't know why. It hadn't been a long time, but I decided I just had to go to work, you know, because that was just, you know how that comes, you know, in your mind. That is the logical thing to do, is to get up and go to work. I don't even know if I got a job. I'll go to the last place I worked. I did still have a job. I worked for the government, you know, and it's easier for them to keep you than to fire you, so it's such a anger. I got to work, and funny thing happened. I got real sick. Thought I was going to die. They had given me the card of a lady who worked in the office building where I worked. I told them that they were mistaken because they didn't hire people who drank where I work. And I have this card and it has Mary on it. They'd wrote it out, Mary S. 300 people in this office building, and I'm thinking, boy, I really need to see Mary S. Maybe she'll know what to do. So I go in the elevator, I go up to personnel, and I said, anybody work here named Mary S? And the lady remembered me from the last time I was at work. So I went. And I got to Irving, and the Irving Group at that time was a storefront building, and I knocked on the door, and the ugliest guy I ever met in my life, DJ. DJ came to the door, and I thought, God, that's an alcoholic. Now, you can recognize him right off the bat. Now, I haven't had a bath in God knows when. I hadn't shaved, hadn't combed my hair. Quit bathing because one night I was taking a bath, and they hid my britches in the liquor store clothes before I could get there. So I took care of that problem. I quit bathing. He said, son, you're in the right place. And I said, really? And he said, yeah. And he said, come on in. And I said, nah, I think I'll just stay out here on the sidewalk. And he said, would you like a cup of coffee? And I said, that sounds really neat. And so he said, well, at least step here in the little atrium here, and so people won't step on you going down the sidewalk. And I stepped in, and he brought me a cup of coffee, and I puked on the carpet. I mean, puked. I mean, resentment that I had built up for days. And I said, now, that's it for AA for me, because when you puke on the carpet, they make you leave. I know that for a fact, because I have a lot of experience with it. And he came back and he looked at me and he got me by the arm and he took me in and he set me down on a couch over in the corner. He didn't say anything about the carpet. He leaves and he comes back and he's got a bucket and a glass. And he said, drink this. And I said, what is it? He said, honey, orange juice, and raw egg. I said, do you want to put that bucket right here between my feet? And I drank it, and I immediately puked in the bucket. He went and got a mop and another bucket, and he cleaned up the hallway in the atrium and came back with another glass. Said, drink this. And I did, and I puked in the bucket. And about my third glass and my third good heartfelt puke, the strangest thing happened. The two men who had been at my house the night before were there. I don't know where they came from. A couple more glasses, and I looked over there, and there was Mary. She was a double dipper. She was also out of nine, so she followed me to make sure I followed the instructions. But I look back, I have four grandchildren and two children, and you remember when your kids are babies and they're just showing inclinations to walk, and you stand them up and you pat them on the behind, and then daddy or mother catches them on the other side of the room. That's the way I view this experience, that Mary stood me up there and patted me on the butt, and they caught me on the other end. And we had a good time that day. We sat and I drank honey, orange juice, and raw eggs and puked in that bucket. And they stood around and told jokes about people who drink honey, orange juice, and raw eggs and puked in that bucket. Until mid-afternoon, I finally said to them, would it be all right with you guys if I just pour this in this bucket? Because I'm getting extremely tired. Now, I don't know if what I'm telling you is true or not. That's the way I remember. I have to be real honest with you. It wasn't that funny that day. One of those men said to me, look, I know you think you're not keeping this down, but every time you drink this, you're retaining a little protein and a little sugar and a little vitamin C, and it's probably going to keep you from going into DTs. And that got my attention, because I knew about those. I had a country and western band that played in my bathroom. And I was the lead singer. And I really wanted to talk to Nancy, though, and I didn't get a chance to, because we have similar backgrounds. She just went public. And Faye worked at the hospital on the 3 to 11 shift. And so at night, the band and I would gather in the back bedroom and play and sing. And one of the greatest shocks I got when I sobered up was to find out I could not play the guitar. And I loved my band, and I cooked for them. The only thing I knew how to cook was grits. And I only knew how to cook them a box at a time. If you cook a whole box of grits, it takes a big bowl, you know. So I had a salad bowl. And if you got a salad bowl full of hot grits, it takes a whole pound of margarine. Now, you guys in Georgia understand this. Well, up north, they look at you funny, but if you got a big bowl full of hot grits with a pound of margarine in it, you cannot eat them with clothes on. I mean, folks, this is just fact. This is common sense. And so I would get naked and sit up in the middle of the bed with this big bowl of grits. And the band would stand around, and I'd feed them grits with this big salad spoon and have a spoonful myself occasionally, which might account for the fact that I weighed 404 pounds when I came to AA. And then Faye would come in, and she'd say, "It's time for the band to leave." And I was scared to death of her. Boy, in a minute, they would be gone. I don't know how those men all got out that door that day, carrying those bass fiddles and amplifiers and all that stuff. So I knew about that. The only other thing I remember about DTs is that plain tap water will not flush green men out of your air conditioner duct. It just won't. They just swim. So they said, "Keep drinking," and I did. Well, they didn't have a meeting in the Irving group that night. It was Wednesday, and the Al-Anons owned the Irving group on Wednesdays. No co-educational stuff in those days, you know. When the Al-Anons were there, the AAs left. Not because they wanted to, they left. It was Al-Anon strong in Texas, right, bud? I mean, they have their own insurance out there called My Fault. So they take me to Grand Prairie, Texas, to my first AA meeting, and they pull up in front of St. Mark's Lutheran Church, I believe it's St. Mark's, downtown Grand Prairie, Highway 80, and I said, "I ain't going in there." And they said, "Why not?" I said, "I knew it. You're all a bunch of holy rollers. I ain't going in there." And they said, "We don't meet in the church. We meet in the fellowship hall." I said, "I ain't going in none of them buildings because that's where God lives, and he don't know where I'm at, and I don't want him to find out." And I attended my first AA meeting sitting in a metal folding chair on the sidewalk beside Highway 80 and listened through the window because I would not go in that building. God's got a sense of humor. And I heard some really good stuff that night. First guy got up, Paul Mack, said I fell off a truck ramp and landed on my head and broke my right leg. Carl C. was next. Carl said, "I came to AA 3 months ago and I was barefooted, didn't have a shirt on my back, didn't have anything to eat." And this guy's standing there in a $300 Western suit, alligator boots. And I said, "Sure." And then Ann C. got up to speak. And she had a husband in prison, had a son in reform school, daughter in Gatesville penitentiary for women, had a son with a brain tumor, and she was going into the hospital the next day for a hemorrhoidectomy. And I could identify with her. I thought, that poor girl, she needs help. And I was going to help her. But they come and got me and put me back in the car and took me back to Irving. Got to Irving and my life changed forever. When I walked into the room there at the Irving group, the Al-Anons had invaded my house. And they had Faye in the middle of the room and they had surrounded her like a wagon train. And I got her out. I rescued her. I got out of there. We got in the car. We hadn't gone two blocks till I knew that my life would never be the same again. I didn't know anything about drinking or not drinking anything, but I knew my life was never going to be the same again. Because she said to me, "They told me I'm not responsible for your drinking." I said, "Well, who is?" I mean, there's only two adults that live at our house, and everybody had told me I was not responsible. So anyway, I started going to AA meetings. Now, I didn't say I got into AA or I joined AA or I discovered AA or found AA. I just said I started going to them dumb old meetings. Hated them. Dumb old discussion meetings. And every night, you know, I'd sit there thinking about what I was going to say when my turn came. And when my turn came, I would say what I wanted to say. And I'd spend the rest of the hour thinking about what I had said. And I don't know why y'all are laughing, because every one of you has done the same thing. Except on Saturday night. Saturday night in Irving, they have beginners meeting. I love beginners meeting. Still do. And when I'm in Irving, I always go to the beginners meeting. Very interesting. They have one old timer. And he sits there, and I know now that the reason he sits there is to keep it from getting so deep somebody drowns. And they let these folks just say anything they want to because they need to say it. And beginners meeting is really neat. You know, the first speaker would say something like, I used to drink shoe polish. And the next speaker would say, that ain't nothing. I used to drink kerosene lit. Next speaker said, I once got drunk in Memphis and woke up in Nashville. Next speaker said, why ain't nothing. I got drunk one time in Hong Kong, China, and woke up in Montreal, Canada in my car. Next speaker said, I've been married 6 times. Next speaker said, ain't nothing. I've been married 3 times since lunch. Once to my sister. And I'm sitting there waiting on my turn. Now, we had in our group this irascible old fart, and you'll have to look that word up if you don't know, but Curly was irascible. And he had this irritating habit of asking the group questions and looking right at me. And I always tried to help him by answering. And he stopped the meeting, and he said, I'd like to ask everybody here a question. Look right at me. Have any of you ever been so drunk that you did not remember what you did? And I said, well, of course. I'd like to ask everybody else a question. Looks right at me. Have you ever woke up in the bed with a 95-year-old woman with sores all over her body? I said, no. He said, how do you know? That remark by that old man put me squarely into the middle of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was no longer an outsider. I was no longer an observer. I was sunk right square in the middle. I got up and walked out. I went to my sponsor's house. I have to tell you about my sponsor. I guess I loved him as much as I ever loved any man. Al came up to me one night at a meeting and he said, I'm Al Z and I'm your sponsor. And I said, I haven't chosen a sponsor yet. And he said, yes, you have. And I'm him. I said, I thought you got to choose your own sponsor. He said, you do, you did, and I'm him. I said, I don't know if I'm ready for sponsorship. He said, I don't either, but nonetheless, I'm your sponsor. And he looked at me and said, you don't understand this, do you? And I said, no, sir, I don't. He said, we had a meeting, and we drew straws, and I lost. In September of 1971, in the Irving Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, there was a meeting of the steering committee.
And the topic of the meeting was whether or not to allow me to continue to come to meetings because I was so disrupted. So I found out very early that the eardrum and the jawbone don't work at the same time. And so if you talk, you do not have to listen. And I was very disruptive in meetings. And the general consensus of that meeting was, and all of those men have told me that since, I preached the funeral for most of them. Every one of them has told me since that the general consensus was, if they made me stop attending, I would probably die. But if I were going to be allowed to continue, somebody had to take charge of me. And they did draw straws and held it loose. And that was God's way of taking care of me. And so I went to Al's house that night and I rang the doorbell. He came to the door and I'm standing on the front porch, big tears running down my face. And he said, "What's the matter with you?" And I said, "I've just found out a terrible thing." And he said, "What's that?" I said, "I don't know what I've done." And he said, "None of us do." And I said, "The heck with the rest of you. I'm talking about me." You know, "I don't care about the rest of you guys. I'm talking about me. Do you know that? I don't know what I've done." And he said, "What does that mean?" I said, "I don't know." He said, "It means you can never again look down your nose at another human being because you don't know what you've done. You never again have the right to sit in judgment on anybody else because you don't know what you've done." And he said, "I got another flash for you. You ain't never gonna know." And he said, "It might be that you're ready to take certain steps." And he didn't say, "Read a book, come back, I'll talk to you later." He got me by the arm and he took me in and we began a program that night based on the 12 steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is the only way I know that you can stay sober. Now maybe you have another way, but it's the only way I know that I can stay sober. Al taught me that there were three meanings to AA: Alcoholics Anonymous, absolute abstinence, but the primary and the most important reason of all is admitted and accepted that you are powerless over alcohol and your life has become unmanageable. And when you doubt that, he said, just remember, because of that, you don't know what you've done. I didn't have any problem with step two. I loved step two. I was so happy to find out that I was insane. I thought I was sorry as hell. That's what everybody had told me. Or I'd been to psychiatrists. We all have. You know, we lie to them. They're not bad people. They're just crazy. I work with them all the time. I don't know. They took me to a psychiatrist one time. He looked down and he said, "Son." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "I'm going to give you some pills." I said, "You are?" He said, "Uh-huh." "Now I got to tell y'all something. I'm an alcoholic. But I love pills. I love pills. Big pills, little pills, round pills, square pills, short pills, green pills, red pills, long pills, any kind. I just love pills. Back when I was drinking, I come to your house, first place I go is your bathroom." "I did not have a kidney problem. I wanted to see your medicine cabinet." "I've had enough Midol, I wouldn't have a cramp if I lived 125 years old." I once found a little plastic deal with dates on it. I took the 26th, 27th, and 28th. A friend of mine who's a Jesuit priest up in Ottawa, Canada, Tom Marcoux, you remember Tom, I'm sure. Tom said, "Ray, did it ever occur to you that you may be responsible for getting some woman pregnant you never even met?" So this guy said, "I'm going to give you some pills." I said, "What did they do, Doc?" He said, "They make you deathly sick if you drink." I said, "Hell, I already get deathly sick when I drink." He said, you know you're going to get deathly sick before you drink?" I said, "Uh-huh." He said, "And you get drunk anyway?" I said, "Uh-huh." He said, "Dang, I don't understand that." I said, "Me either." You know what? He was pretty smart. I got deathly sick. Spent 4 days in intensive care, and I guess I would have stayed longer, but I drank the alcohol out of the thermometer jar and put it in me. Never taken more of them pills, though. Like that. And then we got to step three, and I got to tell you something. I told Al, I said, look, I don't want anything to do with this. This is God in it. And he said, son, you know what? The success of the rest of your program depends upon your ability and willingness to accept this step. And I said, well, I don't know how to do that. See, I grew up in Georgia, in LaGrange, Georgia, in a Southern Baptist church. It was at the end of our street. See, they told me that I shouldn't do things that they said because God wouldn't like me. And I couldn't do the things they said. I found out later they couldn't either. But I felt terribly guilty because they would say to me, you know, if you do these things, you know, you got to know God. You got to understand God. And I felt, you know, that there's something incomplete in this because I don't know God. I know who God is. I know about God. I've heard about God. I believe in God. I never had the courage to be an agnostic, just in case he was there, you know. I'm not stupid. I'm not caught. You know, let me explain it this way real quick. 1955, Naval Hospital, San Diego, California, I walked into the nurse's station, and the most gorgeous thing I ever saw was standing there. And I immediately fell into need. And she fell into sickness. And I got to tell you, you know, I don't know if you believe in love at first sight or not, but I just got to tell you, you know, from that day on, it was different. And she said to me, if you want what I've got and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, you must take certain steps. At some of these, I balked. But my efforts were nil until I let go absolutely. Now, she didn't say that, and I didn't say that, but it makes a nice story. The reason I tell you that is the fact that it exemplifies how our relationship with God starts. I didn't know anything about her. We dated 3 whole months. The deepest relationship I had ever had. I'm the only one. And then we got married. And I thought, boy, I know all about her. And she said, you know, I know all about him. And the next morning, we woke up in bed with strangers. All I knew about her was just enough to know I wanted to spend the rest of my life with her. We'll soon be married 45 years. If I come back to speak next year, I would say to you, you know what? I don't know all about her. And God knows she doesn't know all about me. But we still know enough to know that we want to spend the rest of our lives together. And one day, one of us is going to follow the casket down the aisle. I don't know who will go first. We argue about that all the time. We may just go together. Whenever you know. But when that day comes, I won't know all about her. And she won't know all about me. But we'll still know enough about each other to tell us we want to spend the rest of our lives with each other. I don't know all about God. I never knew all about God. But I did know enough to know that my whole future rested in Him. I've been sober almost 20, the 20th of this month for 28 years. If I stay sober 9 more days. I've been a Baptist pastor for 25 years. I've graduated from 2 seminaries. I have 4 college degrees. And I still don't know all about God. But I got to tell you this morning that I knew enough to know He's the only one that can take care of my life. I just retired a month ago. I thought that I was totally immune to retirement anxiety. And I did real well. They hired my replacement. And he showed up. And you know what? All of a sudden, God, the roof fell in last week. And I sat down at my computer that night, and I got on the thing, and I called up my friends in AA, and I'm telling them, that I'm experiencing that hollow hole in my gut with the wind blowing through. I don't want to drink. I just don't know what to do. And some kid with 18 months sobriety. Click, click, click. Sounds to me like you have misplaced your will in your life. You need to find it and give it back to God. Well, I knew where it was. I had it hid in the bathroom. Because that's where I make that decision every morning. I got a little sign on my mirror. It's a see-through sign. You see words on the mirror. It says, you're looking at the problem. And then I've got the third step prayer. And that's the way I begin my day. So I got up and I went in the bathroom and I turned all this back over to God. Everything's okay. Now, I've gotten kind of along with it. I got to tell you what's happened in our lives. We have 2 children, 4 grandchildren. 1981, I believe it was, I told Faye, I said, I'd like to go back to school. She said, well, why don't you? I said, I'd be 50 years old before I graduated. She said, 3 years, you're going to be 50 either way. I know enough to know. So I went back to school. I got a PhD in psychology. I was 50 years old. That same year, our first grandchild was born perfect, absolutely perfect. My little boy was about 2.5 years old. He'd never spent the night away from his parents. I was attending the School of Prophets at First Baptist Church in Dallas, and had a suite in the hotel, and my daughter came to me and said, Daddy, how would you like to take Ryan and keep him overnight? And I said, you'd let me do that? And she said, yeah. Man, you know, I went down to Walmart and got $40 worth of red trucks. And we're up there in that room. That little boy's playing with the trucks, and he threw the truck down. He climbed up in my lap, put his arms around my neck. He said, Papa, I love you. And I cried because, not because the little boy said, I love you, but because I had been trusted by my daughter, who used to be so afraid of me, she would lock herself in the bathroom and sleep in the bathtub. But the most precious possession she had, her child. 3 years later, we had another perfect child, grandchild. 3 years after that, she had a little girl. I was on the way to speak at a conference in Oklahoma. My son-in-law called me and said, Kitty's in labor. I said, I'll be right there. And he said, no. She said, you'd say that, but she's fine. You go on. I called home that night after the meeting. Faye said, we have a granddaughter. That's a kitty. Okay, she's fine. Don't you want to know what she named her? I said, what? She said, named her Jacqueline Ray. Wow. I jumped in my car, and I drove all the way from Oklahoma to Irving, got there at 6 o'clock in the morning. Went to the hospital, woke her up. I said, why didn't you name me the one of them boys, Ray? And she looked at me and she said, Daddy, that's the first name I picked out. The first time I got pregnant, but it just had to be a little girl. Because I want you to know what you mean to me. We have a son, 43 years old. They were never blessed with children. They had totally given up. They'd been to fertility clinics, the adoption agencies. And they finally just resigned to the fact that they just weren't going to have a job. The guy I used to work with, used to sponsor, called him up one day. He knew him. He said, y'all still looking for a baby? He said, well, we kind of give up. He said, my sister is out in Escondido, California. She's sponsoring a girl who's 8 months pregnant. Child Protective Services have already told her they're going to take the baby as soon as it's born because her other 2 children have been removed from the home and they're not going to let a child go into that home. He called me up and he said, Daddy, what do you think I ought to do? I said, well, I think you better get a lawyer real quick. In 3 weeks, they had everything in place. They called them from Escondido. She was in the labor room. They got on a plane after I bought them a ticket. Oh, it was fine. It was fine. They had the money, just couldn't get to it. They fly out to Escondido. They get there. They're in the delivery room when the baby's born. They hand the baby to her. Hospital said, why don't y'all just stay here in the hospital for 4 days and bond with the baby? State of California said they had to stay there 3 weeks till they got the conservatorship. They stayed in the hotel. The hotel just loved them out there. I would call them up, and the lady on the desk would say, oh, he's not here. He's out in the parking lot smoking a cigar. Let me go get him. But, you know, everybody knew the baby. 6 months after that, we had all the papers cleared on both ends and went to court. And the judge saw us. That'd be a judge I knew. And he says, clear the courtroom. I don't want any of this garbage in here this morning. We're going to do something happy. So he said, AA gave us a baby. Boy, he's a pistol. Man. 3 years old. He weighed 11 and a half pounds. He's born. Okay. These are the blessings and the promises of AA that come true. 3 years ago, I'm riding down South Padre Island Drive, saw a sign that said, guitar lessons for adults. Get off the freeway. I run into this store and I said, can you teach me how to play the guitar? And the guy said, I don't know. How much do you know? I said, nothing. He said, I can teach you then. Took guitar lessons for 2 years. Had my own band. We play at the Brass Nail on Friday night. Every other week. I made $42 last year playing the guitar. So that makes me a pro, right? So when I was a little boy, I used to sit on the porch and watch the other people play guitar. My dream was to play the guitar. My dream was to be able to sing for people. If I had done that, I would have died picking the guitar in some honky-tonk 35 years ago, I guess. But you see, my philosophy of religion is this. I had a young boy ask me at seminary not too long ago, Dr. Vowell, what is your philosophy of religion? I've been waiting 40 years, somebody asked me that. I said, get your notebook out, son. He sits down and waits for a pearl of wisdom. And I said, God will give you what you need, when you need it, as soon as you're capable of taking care of it. My dream was to just be able to sit down with other musicians and play the guitar. I have people call me, failed. You failed out of head, I'm listening. I have people call me every day who want me to come play with them. They bought me a Martin guitar. If you don't know anything about guitars, that don't mean anything to you, but I got to tell you something. I got a solid rosewood Martin guitar. It may not be good, but satisfy me. One other thing, I'll shut up. When I got sober, I used to ride motorcycles. Loved motorcycles. I promised this lady that I would not ride motorcycles anymore. I knew how much it frightened her. 3 years ago, three of my friends at church bought new Harleys. They knew it was eating me up. Saw an ad in the paper one day. FLH Dyna Lowrider, 91 model, 1,400 miles, $5,000. I almost died. I read that to Faye every morning while we drank coffee. So one morning she said, why don't you call? I called. I'm sure it won't be there now, but it's a young girl who bought it and she was afraid to ride it. She'd had it in the garage. She just polished it and added chrome to it. Faye and I drove down to see it, and it's a beauty. I got to tell you, it's a beauty. I call it the geezer pleaser. We went home that evening, and Faye said, "Boy, that's really a good buy on that motorcycle." I said, "Yeah." She said, "I think you ought to buy it." I said, "I can't do it. I made you a promise, and I don't break promises anymore." And she said, "It's okay. I know what it means to you." And I said, "I'll buy it on one condition, if you will not be terrified every time I leave the driveway." And she said, "I can't promise you that, but I'll do the best I can." I don't know who's more proud of that bike today, me or her. She won't touch it. I couldn't even get her to sit on it and have our pictures made last Christmas. We have our own motorcycle gang. I'm the leader of the Club de Motociclistas de Viejo Rabo Verdes. That's Spanish for Old Geezer's Motorcycle Club. I'm not an expert in AA. I don't know much. See, we'll have experts here because sober is as high as you get. I know two things. I know which drink makes me drunk. And that would be the first one. And number two, and most importantly, I know who has the ability to help me make that choice. And that's God. Thank you for letting me come and share with you. God bless you.